everyone, and welcome to the Primordial Soup Pot. My name is Aaron.
And I'm Rustin.
Every 2 weeks, Russ and I get together to discuss topics in the field of ecology, natural history, and evolution. And this week, we're back at Halloween again, spooky season.
Absolutely, absolutely. This is our third Halloween episode. We've done one every single season.
Mm-hmm. They're usually our most popular ones. I have the most fun with them personally.
Yeah, there are a lot of different routes you can go with this. So, yeah, a lot of different things scare people.
I mean, half the stuff we talk about is kind of scary to some people if you think about it. How many times have we talked about a bug?
Right. Right. Yeah, there are a lot of things in nature that people just find generally unnerving. I think we've probably done 4 or 5 other episodes that could probably pass for Halloween episodes if we release them in October.
Well, there's like objectively scary things, and then there's a lot of people don't like roaches, you know, kind of on par with that. I mean, if like I see a rat in my room, I'll probably jump too. No, that's not where the rats are supposed to be.
Like, it's one thing if there's a serial killer coming after me, but like, if I find a roach in my place, that's almost scarier because then I got to like get management and maintenance involved, bug bomb my place. I got to wrap up all my stuff. At that point, just kill me.
That's the thing about serial killers. There's usually only one in your house at a time.
Right. Right.
Roaches, you know, there's always going to be another.
Right. Exactly. They come in groups.
And, you know, serial killer, that's a one-on-one. You know, that could be an even fight. Roaches, they got like guerrilla tactics. You know, that's not fair.
Yeah, exactly. They don't fight you out in the open. They hide in corners. They steal your food.
Disrupt supply lines.
Right. They crawl across your feet in the dead of night. They use psychological warfare, man. It's not fair. It's really not.
Anyways, so Halloween, and we'll be talking, I guess, some more objectively scary topics today. So usually I would be up first. I'm going to be completely honest with you. I have 10 pages.
What?
Full paragraphs. Yeah, So if you want to go first, that's fine. My bit will probably take a while. Hey, I'm editing it, so I mean, it's...
Well, that's lucky. Damn,
I fell
okay.
into a rabbit hole. I was staying up late, and I wanted to see it through to the end.
Okay, well, luckily for you, my piece is on the shorter side. So I guess I'll go first. For a Halloween episode, like we were talking about, there are a lot of different options to consider. You got monsters, you got animals, you got plants. You know, you've talked about a cryptid or two in past Halloween episodes, mm-hmm. The Beast of Chevaudan. But ultimately, what's more appropriate for a Halloween episode than a good haunting, really? And at this point, I kind of had to pare things down a lot because we're doing a podcast about ecology here, and many hauntings involve someone creepy or weird dying and then sticking around a bit too long, which isn't really ecology related. Right? So it doesn't really fit this podcast.
No, it does. Is there a ghost ecologist that I don't know about?
There could be. But the kicker is I also don't know about them, so they won't feature in this podcast.
Another time, maybe.
Luckily for me, though, there are actually a couple instances where nature has created naturally haunting places that have inspired fear and then myth among people. One such place is actually here in the eastern United States in North Carolina. Specifically, I'm talking about the Devil's Tramping Ground. Does that ring any bells for you?
No, I have not heard of this.
All right, let me get into it then. The Devil's Tramping Ground itself is actually kind of basic if you just describe it. Specifically, the site is almost dead center in North Carolina, positioned right between Greensboro, Durham, and Charlotte, that kind of triangular area in the center of the state. It's quite simply a clearing in the woods with two different paths that lead to and away from the clearing, connecting it to other nearby paths and roads. Pretty simple, right? Not that crazy. But it starts to become a bit more eerie when you start getting into the details here, because the clearing itself is actually a perfect circle, 40 feet wide. No one maintains this circle. The site has no landscapers or anything like that. Of further interest is that almost nothing grows in this circle. There's no trees, no bushes, or any other kind of vegetation that grows here, except for this short, wiry grass that can't grow anywhere else. Locals have actually tried to transplant the grass, and it always dies. It only grows in this one clearing.
Did, like, a tanker spill some arsenic? Kind of formed a patch, and then, I don't know, that was the only thing that lived?
Maybe.
Is this, like, off the side of a highway or in the middle of woods?
It's in the middle of the woods. And it's actually on private property these days. But because of the history of the site and the way it's been described in the past, it has a whole bunch of legends that surround it. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Because according to these records, the site has been like this for centuries. So that rules out your arsenic theory. There have been centuries of nothing growing in a clearing in the woods, which is very, very strange. Usually succession takes over within a few years, and you have bushes and then large trees, and eventually there was no clearing at all. This spot has been barren for decades upon decades upon decades. The written accounts of this site go back to the 1800s, and oral accounts date from centuries earlier than that. It's likely been this way since before Columbus landed in the New World. It's that old. It's so mysterious that we don't even know who first named it, really. It just kind of has this name now. There's no record of somebody first writing about it in an article or anything like that. Naturally, there are a lot of different legends that have cropped up around a site that's this creepy. Unlike a haunted place with human origins, a naturally haunted spot spawns a lot of myths instead of just one. What kind of Halloween episode would this be if I didn't discuss all of them? So, let me get into it. The most prominent one, which likely inspired the clearing's name, says that every night, the devil walks into the clearing from one path, then walks around in circles plotting new evil machinations for humanity, and then leaves via the other path. It's the one you most commonly hear about.
This is personal roundabout.
Honestly, yeah. It's just where he goes to think. You know, we all need a spot like that. We all need a little quiet place. His is just in the middle of North Carolina. Go figure.
Here, I thought the devil was going down to Georgia. This is where he practices his fiddle.
Right. This is where he stops.
That's what it is.
This is where he stops to practice the fiddle on the way to Georgia. A little clearing.
Damn farm kid. Took my damn golden fiddle. Any idea how much that cost?
Goddamn. Johnny. Little bastard. Anyway. Other stories, however, involve Native Americans. One such story states that the natives would use this clearing for feasts before battle, where they would perform their war dances. This story is a bit odd to me, personally, because while Native Americans had war dances that they would perform, the story doesn't quite explain how those dances would have cursed the clearing or prevented any vegetation from growing here. So, it's a bit weird.
Well, you know, I mean, any dance, if done properly, will prevent vegetation from growing. You trample it.
Yeah. I mean, sure, but that depends on the vegetation.
You know, if I was doing the Cupid shuffle all day in my backyard, you see a grid pattern over time. I wouldn't toss that theory out, personally.
What, were you cursed?
Like, did somebody come hobbies.
Up to you? Like, did a wizard come up to you and say you will only perform the Cupid shuffle forever?
There's worse curses to have.
I mean, I guess so, but damn, you'd get sick of it after like even just an hour, right?
And so would my yard. That's where the patterns come from.
Yeah, instead of the devil's tramping circle, you'd have the devil's tramping square.
Exactly.
The second main story that involves the Native Americans that I read was that a great battle happened between two tribes at this location, and the chief of one of those tribes was killed. The chief was then buried underneath the clearing, which stayed empty because the spirits, the lingering spirits of warriors from the battle who were stayed there and were mourning the loss of their leader. There's another theory that says that treasure is buried underground here, and that through leakage into the soil or from some curse upon the treasure, the ground has become sterile. There was also an event in the 1930s where some hunters claimed to be chased away from the spot by a giant black beast that resembled a bear. This one doesn't really seem that supernatural. It seems like they just ran into a bear in the woods. And then tried to make it sound like some monster.
We're chased by this giant black beast. What'd it look like? A bear. Was it a bear? No.
Right.
It seems something
like
else.
Seems like the kind of thing they said after about 4 or 5 beers.
Yeah.
Not really anything that scary. But the final theory here is that aliens landed at this spot and did something to this one little circle of forest. So I guess conspiracy theorists should raid the Devil's Tramping Ground now that Area 51 has been overrun.
Next best spot. Are those all the main myths?
Pretty much, yeah. Those are the main ones that I could find. Of course, there are all kinds of other different conspiracy theories, but those are the main ones you run into.
I like the dancing one. I think that's my favorite.
The dancing
Personally,
one?
The treasure one is the easiest to dismiss. I mean, you know, get a shovel. Okay. Yeah, we can figure that one out in an afternoon, whether it's true or not. But I don't know, the dancing.
Personally, I think the one about the devil, you know, the mainstream one is probably my favorite. You know.
Yeah, that one is nice, too. He just needs a place to think, you know?
Now that I've explained some of these legends, should I do my best to ruin them by trying to explain why the clearing stays empty?
Yeah, I think you have to now.
Of course, eventually, people started testing the soil at this site for various chemicals. Any ideas on what they found?
Arsenic?
Nope.
I'm out. I was banking on that one.
Well, the first idea they had was that maybe the soil had a very high copper content. This is because there's a lot of copper in this area of North Carolina, so it would make sense, but they didn't find any extreme levels of copper in the soil from the Devil's Tramping Ground. Indeed, there really wasn't much of anything that seems remarkable about this soil based on the tests that scientists have run. The one thing that is unusual is the salinity, which is higher than most other soil, but, and that would seem to explain this phenomenon, right? Most plants can't grow above a certain salinity, and there are certain plants that are salt tolerant that don't survive in other kinds of soil, so that tracks, right? The thing is, the salinity levels measured in this soil are not high enough to kill vegetation and keep the ground bare in the way that is observed at this site. So really, we don't know why it's a clearing. We don't know why nothing grows there. Even now, it's still a mystery.
I thought I'd get more closure out of this.
No, I said I would try to explain it. I didn't say I'd succeed.
Well, like I say, I try to explain something, but I was just thinking it was a complicated topic, you know, the way you were wording it.
No, it's possible that one of these days we might get an explanation from a test or some kind of study. We just don't know. Yeah, I guess it is possible that eventually we find video footage of some kids doing donuts in this clearing that kills all the grass, but we don't have that right now, so...
Well, that kind of sucks.
It kind of does, but it also doesn't, you know? It keeps the mystique going, especially for a Halloween topic. You like a little bit of the unknown. It makes things scarier. So I don't know. I kind of like that it's still a mystery.
All right, well, do you have any of your own theories? As plausible as they may be. You could toss out another alien one, and I guess there's no way to disprove it. The only thing we can rule out is the treasure, because someone would have, like, digging that up by now.
I mean, sure, but it's also possible that somebody dug up the treasure and moved it away, but the curse from the treasure remains.
Residual curse. Maybe the chest was cursed, but not the treasure.
Yeah, and the chest just kind of decomposed over time, but the curse lived on.
Or maybe the curse is just based off latitude and longitude. It had nothing to do with the treasure. Once you pull it out, it's fine.
And the treasure was only cursed because it was here?
Yeah, some witch was trying to curse the treasure, but she actually cursed the location. The treasure's completely fine.
A classic goof-up. I mean, personally, I think salinity could play a factor, but the experts were saying that salinity wasn't high enough to really explain why things die when they're planted here. I think that from a scientific perspective, there's probably just another chemical that they haven't detected yet. It could be a while before we figure out what it is. So that's my inclination.
I thought for sure that you were going to say it was ants.
Could be.
Because I know sometimes ants will clear out other plant life because there's like a one that they have a relationship with, like commensalism.
Sure.
Like some acacia trees. But
yeah,
I figured if that were the case, we would see ants. Like, I feel that one is probably pretty easy to dismiss.
Yeah. Yeah. Plus, you can also go camping here. So I feel like it wouldn't be a popular camping ground if there were ants all over the place.
It's just a giant anthill. Yeah, I don't think people would be coming back. Maybe the plants secrete something? I don't know.
Maybe, but personally, I don't really have any plausible theories of my own at this point. And I kind of like it that way, honestly. So,
you know, it's nice for some mystery to remain in the world.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. On a final note, if you want to see the place for yourself, you can book a camping trip, like I just said, to the Devil's Tramping Ground. However, the place is on private property, so please be respectful. Some of the articles that I read mentioned that the landowners were having to clean up like trash and litter that were left at the site, which is really sad and a shame. You know, it's a cool spot. You should be respectful. Regardless, who knows? Maybe one of these days we might get a definitive explanation for the Devil's Tramping Ground, whether scientific or supernatural.
Well, really cool. Never heard that before. Very interesting piece. Yeah, you're right. It does irk me a little bit to not know what the end is, but I guess it's nice that there's still mysteries. There's still something for someone else to solve later down the line.
Right. Like, sometimes that's good. We don't know what's in the box in Pulp Fiction. We don't know whether the top falls over in Inception. You know, some things like that are nice.
The top does fall over.
According to you.
No. Who's the British guy in the movie? The actor. The British actor. The old dude.
Michael Caine?
Yeah, Michael Caine said every scene he was in was real life, according to the script, in an interview. And he was in that last scene.
Okay, but Michael Caine could just be making shit up, honestly.
He said that was according to the script.
Of course he would say that.
It was years later. He didn't have to say it at all.
Right, that's my point. He didn't have to say it. He's just trying to get a reaction.
Well, I mean, that's the closest answer we got.
Sure.
Or you he could said just specifically he was only in scenes in real life.
Or maybe it's just designed to be ambiguous. And we don't need an answer, a definitive answer from the creators of the movie. We can just, you know, think whatever we
want. We got it from
one
of the actors.
Right, but we don't need that.
But we got it.
But it's unnecessary. And he could just be making shit up.
I like closure. I want to know what happens. I don't watch TV shows unless they're finished.
Speaking of which, you got to watch Game of Thrones.
No, it has a bad ending. Not touching it. You can't argue with me that it's a bad ending. Like, I was in the house when people were screaming at the TV.
Sure, it was a bad ending. But it's still a cultural touchstone, man. You gotta know Game of Thrones.
I know the Starks and the dragons, the White Walkers. Is that what they're called?
Maybe.
The zombies, the frost zombies.
That might be what they're called. You'll have to watch the show to find out.
Okay. Moving on.
All right, what is this trilogy of a piece you've got for me?
Guys, so long.
Decathlon of a piece you have.
I don't know if I mentioned this. I was up till 4 in the morning. I just fell into a rabbit hole and I wanted to keep going.
Well, it sounds like our listeners are going to be up until 4 a.m. if they want to listen to this whole podcast.
Hey, well, it's my turn to edit, so you're lucky on this one.
Yeah. If you're listening to this episode and you think it's a bit long, just remember, Aaron had to edit this.
Yeah, there's probably half an hour being cut out.
Yeah, Aaron had to listen to this, each bit of this, probably 2 or 3 times. You only have to listen to it once.
So, it is Halloween once again, and every Halloween, I like to focus on some sort of monster or legend, like you just did with the Devil's Tramping Ground. And, of course, I like to pick one that has enough basis in reality to justify being part of an ecology podcast. In past years, I did the Beast of Gévaudan, which was a French cryptid that killed several peasants in the 1700s. And while the culprit isn't fully known, it's likely that it was just a bad year for wolves. The following year, I did dragon worms, which were a parasitic worm that was once extremely present throughout the world. Now it's very rare. And I'm going back to the traditional monster route, and I'll be discussing the Tsavo Man-Eaters. Have you heard of these before?
No.
Okay, so you're in for a roller coaster then.
Oh, wow, okay.
So I'll start with the history of the event, and then I'll end back to a more scientific-based analysis on how and why it happened. So the Tsavo Man-Eaters were a pair of male lions that hunted several railroad workers in the Tsavo region of Kenya between March to December of 1898. During this time, Africa was still part of the British Empire, or many parts of it was, and one railroad company sought to undertake building of a railroad connecting Uganda to Kenya. This would allow for better trade if you could access the Indian Ocean. So thousands of mostly Indian workers were brought over to work along this 8-mile stretch, with camps spaced out along the line. And over the course of 9 months, a pair of these lions began hunting and killing railroad workers, literally dragging them from their tents at night. And it got bad enough that all production was halted because nobody wanted to work on the railroad. Of course, about this time, Lieutenant Colonel John Henry Patterson came into play. Or actually, he was there at the start. He was charged with overseeing the construction of the railroad. Patterson did kill the Tsavo Man-Eaters, and he wrote a book about it. He had a first-hand account. So that's what I'm going to do for this first part, is just kind of paraphrase his semi-biography, The Tsavo Man-Eaters. It was published in 1927, and it's free to read online. And this was a nice change of pace, because usually you have to go through 5 or 6 different sources, but the fact that we have a first-hand account that's published online for free, you know, it's not perfect, take it with a grain of salt, but it is helpful. So Patterson described his arrival into the region surprisingly fondly. Usually high-ranking British military officials tend to look down on tropical environments as sort of primitive. But, you know, he thought there was a spirit of adventure. So shortly after his arrival, Patterson said how one or two workers had simply been dragged from their tents at night and killed. He initially dismissed these claims. He thought it was actually foul play between some of the workers, maybe a dispute over money or resources, and they just, you know, claimed it was a line to cover it up. Then 3 weeks after this, one of Patterson's officers was killed. And there are several witnesses for this. There were a bunch of people in a tent, and Ungun Singh happened to be right by the tent opening when a lion just came in, dragged him by the throat, and ran off with him. That was it. It was over in seconds. He was just gone. As soon as it grabbed him by the throat, it just killed him there on the spot and then dragged his body away. So I'm betting all the workers were drawing straws after that to see who had to sit by the tent opening that night. Patterson tracked the beast down with another officer, and he found only the head of Singh intact, with blood marks leading off into the distance. So at this point, undisputed, okay, there was a lion attack. Patterson perched up in a tree, and he claimed that at the time, several workers actually wanted to stay up there with him, and he had a goat tied at the bottom as bait. That night, the lions attacked a railhead camp, half a mile away from where he was, doing the same technique of dragging the person closest to the tent opening by the neck, killing them, and just taking them off. The unfortunate reality is that there were 8 work sites along this 8-mile stretch of railroad, and the lions would select a different camp every night. That meant that Patterson often was at the wrong camp when the attack happened. It was almost as if they knew where he would be. And the attacks did grow more frequently. So every night, he would kind of move from one site to another, hope that's where the lions would be. They weren't there. They hit another site. He described 2 accounts that he claimed lightened the mood a little bit. His sense of humor it's a little out there. Once, where an Indian trader was riding his donkey at night when a lion attacked them. It wounded the donkey and it went to kill the man, but actually got tangled in a pair of cans that were tied to a rope that he just had draped over his donkey. It got wrapped around the lion's tail, and it actually scared him off, because as he was running, the cans were jingling behind him. So the trader survived that. Later, a Greek trader was passing through, and the lion raided his tent. But in the confusion of, you know, raiding a tent at night in a brief few-second interval, the lion actually pulled his mattress out instead of him. So he was unharmed. The lion pulled out the mattress and presumably dumped it and then just ran off. He died later of thirst crossing the desert. I don't know why Patterson included this, but he's like, yeah, he survived this, but he died later. Don't worry.
You could tell it was that lion's first day on the job. You know, he'd been given some instructions by experienced personnel and was left to his own devices and then came back with a mattress. And they're like, what the hell, man? We can't eat this. You grabbed the wrong thing. He's like, I don't know. It was dark.
Yeah, he probably realized halfway on the way back, he's like, this is a funny tasting person. Foamy.
He just saw two lumps in the tent. I'll drag out the heavier one. That's going to have more food involved.
He chose poorly.
One more question about that incident, though. What did the guy die of? Was it sleep deprivation?
Oh, he died of dehydration. The Greek trader.
Oh, that's not as funny.
No, it's not. There's no reason to include that, but he did. So I also did. Oh, in a similar event, a lion raided a tent and he maimed a couple people. One guy's shoulder was badly injured, but then he accidentally grabbed the sack of rice instead of the guy whose shoulder he injured.
These lions are terrible at hunting humans. I'm sorry. They're just not good.
People in the tent described it as the lion dropped the rice in disgust a short distance after he left the tent once he realized what he had done.
Initially, you described this as like a surgical procedure by these lions. Like they come in, they grab them by the neck and they leave. Like they got this down to a science. But now they're just looking more like the Nazgul and the Fellowship of the Ring when they think the hobbits are in the wrong inn. They wind up stabbing a bunch of pillows and beds.
It really is the same thing. I think he included this just to show that it was the early days and they were still figuring things out, if you want to personify them like that. At least that was his implication in the journal entry. Or maybe it's just to lighten the mood a little bit. But at the end of the day, everyone's still fearing for their lives if they're going to get taken in the middle of the night. Patterson described these early comical attacks as a lion's adapting to human environments. Later, they would not be repelled by loud noises, fires, or fences. At the time, workers were constructing fences from thorny branches. Like, they were building their own fences, literally off of stuff they were just scavenging. So it kind of says a lot when the workers literally have to forage for their own protection.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty bad.
Later on, Patterson morbidly described the situation as a sort of lottery. There were a few thousand workers at each campsite at the time. Lions only took one person every few nights, so you just hope the odds are on your side. But most of these workers transferred to another project, which only left a few hundred in much more cramped and anxious conditions. They built the bomas, which were the fence made from the thorny branches I mentioned, and kept fires lit all around. One man stood watch and regularly shook oil cans attached to a rope to frighten off lions. It didn't work, and later that night, a lion actually raided a medical tent. And while the doctor barely escaped, his wounded patient wasn't so lucky.
Wow.
Okay. Another knight had a worker get dragged off by his feet. He was actually in the middle of the tent, and it was his feet pressing against the side, and the lion apparently reached under the tent, pulled him through before crushing his throat and dragging him away. Everyone in the tent witnessed it happen, too.
What they also witnessed was that he grabbed the pillow in the corner first before he actually grabbed a human.
Yeah, he screwed up a couple times. You know those videos where you see the cats reach under the door and they're like trying to grab something?
Yeah.
It's like that with the lion. So he feels the person. Patterson described his first encounter taking up post with a Dr. Brock. Patterson claimed that one of the lions lunged at them and they barely escaped. Both fired their weapons, scaring it off, but neither of them hit. And then there's a total tone shift in the book where I think Patterson was seeing a different work assignment. Or the lions just took a break, because the next chapter had him in the jungle instead of, you know, out in the scrubland. He built a raft for fun and then accidentally flipped it. He was hunting game birds and he befriended a small antelope, which got stuck in a construction site with a basket on its head. And it later became his pet who he would hand feed. He also described an incident as comical where he photographed several workers nearly escaping a rock slide. Okay, they barely escaped. Another time, there's a worker who started a fight that got a few people badly injured, and he pretended he was too ill to be responsible for it, so Patterson lit a fire under his bed to prove that he was faking the illness. And of course, he sprinted out of bed. But yeah, the dude is, I don't know, maybe a bit dicey in the character section.
Oh, for sure. I'm on the side of the worker on that one. I mean,
well, I mean, there definitely were workers like assaulting each other. You know, you get a lot of people in cramped conditions. There is violence.
Like, oh, sure, sure. All I'm saying is that I could have the worst kind of stomach flu imaginable. If somebody lights my bed on fire, yeah, I'm going to run out of there. That's totally valid.
There's also accounts of attempted mutinies.
I wonder why.
Yeah, I wonder why. There's a time where he fired his gun as a warning shot to get everyone back to work. He was basically spying on them, and he looked down and he saw everyone was just like relaxing instead of working. And he fired his gun and they all started working.
Wow, he sounds like kind of the worst. Honestly. Yeah, I
mean, he has his moments, I guess.
That's one way of putting it.
I mean, this is all by his account, too, so...
Yeah, how much worse was he actually?
I don't know, per se. I'm just going off of his own word on things. I mean, he has moments where he defines, like, workers as, you know, this was a hardworking young man. He didn't deserve to die. It's like, okay, well, that's respectful.
But he still died on my watch. Brilliant supervisor that I am.
All right, well, you know, if you're dealing with man-eating lions and you're just one guy, I'll cut you some slack.
All I'm saying is you gotta follow those OSHA protocols, man.
Yeah, he does. So, anticipating the lion's return, Patterson made a sort of trap inside a tent. It had a false entry and a door suspended by a rope that would drop down. It's basically like just any trap for a wild animal. You know, they walk in, there's a bait, and then the door closes behind them. But in this case, there was a wall between the bait and the entry. And to his credit, he used himself as bait. So for the first few nights, he would sleep in this compartment, you know, with a door kind of open. But there was bars between him and the lion, hoping the lion would walk in. They could drop the door and trap it. You know, he did use himself as bait.
And that is surprising, because based on what you've told me about this guy, I would expect him to use one of the workers as bait, and then after they were inevitably killed by a lion, describe them as, you know, they were a hard worker. They didn't deserve to die like that.
So he did use the workers. However, by all accounts, it seems like the trap was safer than the tents they were in. So I think it was if you're in the trap, you have a physical wall preventing the lion from getting to you. The tents is just fabric.
Okay.
So they might have actually preferred to sleep in the trap. Because, like, they have a compartment to keep them safe.
I guess, but it's also kind of insulting. We care so little about you that we're willing to use you as bait to catch the lions.
Well, it never worked. They never took the bait in this trap anyway. So, like I said, it's probably safer than the tents. Other attempts were also made at the time with poisoned carcasses, but the lions never took the bait. So the lions supposedly got bolder. Instead of attacking one at a time, where one would kind of stay lookout and the other would grab a person, they would both go in together. They would take two people per night now instead of one. And he said they were getting bolder in the sense that they weren't even dragging the victims that far away. He said one night they consumed them only 30 yards from the campsite, rather than taking them, you know, like half a mile away.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Much so that the workers could sometimes hear the lions, like, eating the person. The person was dead. They weren't screaming for their life, but that makes it better.
Yeah, that's still horrifying.
It's very horrifying. And the cycle continues. The camps were spread out. Patterson could only be at one per night. He thought that the lions might have been aware of his presence and attacked whichever campsite he wasn't at. Of course, he would, you know, use bait. Sometimes that was poisoned meat carcasses. Sometimes it was a live goat chained up. Didn't work. The thorny barriers didn't really seem to work anymore. Neither did the fires. Patterson described this as a ritual where people would yell, "Kabar dar, bayan, Satan ata." I'm probably not pronouncing that right. "Beware, brothers, the devil is coming." Then the next morning, there'd just be another person missing a roll call. Most of the workers would try to throw rocks, torches, or shoot at it if they were armed. I don't know how many of them were, but at least a couple were. But the lions just, you know, it just happened so quickly that sometimes I couldn't even recognize it. Especially if it slowly stalked up to your campsite, went in and out, and it was gone.
Wow.
And a lot of people they were taking were probably sick or emaciated. You know, you're working out in the desert. Disease is rampant in close quarters conditions. So it was dehydration, malnutrition. There's not much you can do. And you might be so focused on yourself just getting to the next day that you can't keep watch of the person next to you. And like I said, there's accounts where they would just take people from infirmary tents. Like, they were already wounded. It's like, all right, you know, easy pickings. It was sad. Can't imagine what it felt like to be a worker at the time. That is terrifying. So Patterson said he could hear the lions eating bones at night, but he couldn't stray far from the campsites because he had no visibility out there. I mean, he could take torches and lamps with him, but you're in the middle of nowhere. It's pitch black. A torch can only do so much. He did let workers stay in his private camps on occasion. Sometimes this was a tent. Other times he had a shack to stay in, kind of varied on where he was at. So he did let people stay with him. And by this time, the work had halted for almost 3 weeks as there was a mass strike. The workers were fleeing in droves. Those who remained either built huts high up on top of water tanks or roofs, or they actually dug pits in their tents and then would put heavy logs on top of them at night and sleep in these holes. And then collectively, they would all lift the roofs out in the morning. Patterson actually described an incident where several workers climbed a tree during an attack, which then broke under the weight, hurling all of them back towards the ground with the lions. Unfortunately, the lion had already grabbed the person, so everyone in the tree, they weren't on the menu anymore. And I have no idea what the response from the government or railroad company was at this time. They might have dismissed his claims. However, when a district officer did finally arrive with a group of soldiers, he was attacked and ambushed at a train station. He had a young assistant that was with him, and he said that he went to see if the district officer arrived, and there was just a lion there. And Patterson, I don't know why he didn't believe the boy at first, because he's been up close with them so many times now. And then sure enough, the district officer arrives and shows the scar on his back and is like, yeah, I got jumped by a lion. It killed one of my guards.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so the kid was telling the truth. On December 9th, the first lion was killed. After attacking a trader and his donkey, the trader did survive, fortunately. One of the workers alerted Patterson. He rallied a large group, surrounded the lion with a patch of force. All the workers stood around the patch with cans, drums, any loud thing they had. They all simultaneously started making noise and yelling, except for one opening, where Patterson was. So essentially, he was kind of drawing it out away from the noise where he could wait and shoot it. He did have one barrel misfire, but he did land the shot. In his journal, he actually said that he fumbled this pretty badly, saying that after the misfire, he panicked, he forgot that he had another barrel, and instinctively went to reload his rifle. And in that, he only got the lion in the leg. The lion did escape. He returned later that night alone, waiting in a tree near the donkey carcass. The lions didn't have much time to eat it, so he actually tied it up with wires in hopes they would return. The lion began to stalk Patterson, but he landed a second shot in the brush, anticipating where it was. He heard some labored breathing, limping, and then silence. And sure enough, lion one was dead. All the camps came out with horns and drums to celebrate. It was a nice little office work party. You know, pizza for everyone.
I don't know about pizza, but certainly lots of lion.
Yeah, certainly lots of lion. The next morning, they obtained the body of the lion. The workers carried the lion and Patterson. Apparently, they like lifted him up on his shoulders back to the camp. Measured over 9 feet long from nose to tail, roughly 3 meters, and had two bullet holes, one in the heart and the other in its leg. The other lion did not give up on its attacks, but it switched to livestock instead for the time being. Patterson used goats as bait again, but was unable to hit the lion. He had a few more close calls. Eventually, he and his gun hand, Mahina, took down the beast. They slowly tracked it around the jungle, gradually weakening it over the span of, I believe, a couple days, until Patterson took it down for good when it was going for one final charge. The lion had a similar size to the other, just a little smaller. It had 6 bullet holes in it and 1 shot from a slug. The second and final Tsavo Maneater had fallen. Patterson received praise and respect from the workers and locals. At least according to him, he did. You know, maybe they still hated him, just slightly less. He never dealt with any attempted mutinies again, and he even received a special recognition from the Prime Minister back in Britain. And newspapers he was compared to, the likes of Theseus, Hercules, or St. George, slaying some sort of mythical threat to the land. Work picked up again, and the railroad eventually finished. At the time, the death toll ranged at least a minimum of 28 documented Indian workers were, you know, recorded as being killed. And there's an unknown amount of local Africans or traders that were also part of that. Patterson continued his military career. He fought in the First World War, continued exploring Africa, where he actually discovered a new subspecies of a land. The lion pelts and skulls from the lions were kept as trophies. And in 1924, following the success of his book, he sold them to the Chicago Field Museum, where they reconstructed the animals. Unfortunately, they're a little janky looking because they were rugs. So they couldn't construct them perfectly. They're a bit smaller. But they're still there to this day. They're one of the main exhibits.
Oh, that's cool.
Patterson settled down in California until his death in 1940s at 79. The Savo Maneater's book was a major success. Theodore Roosevelt liked it so much, he actually went hunting with Patterson.
Oh, wow.
That's saying a lot. The book went on to inspire many movies like The Buona Devil, Killer of Kilimanjaro, and Ghost in the Darkness. And typically, this is where the story ends. Historically, you know, the lions are dead. Progress resumed. The death toll range anywhere from 30 to over 100 by various sources. There's no real great record keeping. Also worth noting, we are going off a single guy's account here. There's no doubt he did kill the lions. We have photos of him next to the lions. The lions, they have bullet holes in them. And the lions were also covered in scars from thorny bushes. And they know that those lions were forcing their way through thorny bushes that they were using as fences. So, by all accounts, he did kill the lions.
Hmm.
But we don't know how much of the story was embellished or how often he took rumors as being true. Because a lot of these, he's getting accounts from people in the work sites telling him, like, oh, it took this person in this manner. Could have been a language barrier thrown through the grapevine, just gets altered over time. We don't know. But we can accept the fact that he did kill the lions, and it was by no means an easy task. Fortunately, and unlike accounts of other killer animals, we have something useful. We have the remains of the animals. They're still in the Chicago Field Museum. As science has advanced over the years, we can determine more about the natural history of these lions through various testing. So actually, this is like my second part, where now we're transitioning to the science side of things. Like I said, my God, this was a doozy. I dragged this out. So at initial advance of the Savo Maneaters, they were a pair of adult male lions. Something interesting is the males in the Savo region of Kenya actually don't have manes.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's just a trait not really found in this population. There's a couple theories. Some are that the manes prevent heat loss, and Savo region is notably hot. This really isn't necessary to prevent heat loss. That being said, a lot of Africa is kind of hot, so I guess it gets colder at night in those regions too. I'm not an expert on that. Others state that because how thorny the environment is, the manes will get snagged in the abundant foliage. This one might not be true for a reason I'll get to in a minute. And then there's also theories that it may be linked to increased testosterone of these lions, and that it could be similar to male pattern balding is the reason why they have little to no manes. They do have increased testosterone. I don't know if it really affects mane development.
You're saying there could be just for men, or Rogaine for lions?
Rogaine.
Or Romaine, if you will?
They just need to put like a thing of Bosley in like a pit, and they would have gone in after it. Or a toupee.
Ah, yeah.
They're just self-conscious the whole time. One of the biggest studies into the remains of these lions and their history as a whole was a paper called The Science of Man-Eating, which is, you know, really cool. It discussed the conditions that led to these attacks. So kind of the why it happened. So some conditions like urban development, increased farming may drive large predators to focus on livestock and thus people by extension. As people expand into the wilderness is expanding into the people at the same time.
Sure.
Other circumstances like an injured jaw or tooth may prevent a predator from focusing on tougher prey items that they usually forage for. And there's other factors like seasonal rains might play into this. Most prey animals disperse during the rainy season as part of a regular cycle. Because of this, it's harder for lions to track down their prey. Something that's probably played a larger role is that the elephants were almost extinct in this region due to the ivory trade, hunted by people. Elephants are known for engineering the ecosystem. They actually reduce the thorny vegetation. So this region that was just filled with thorny bushes wasn't like that. And in modern day that we've had some reintroduction efforts, it actually doesn't look like that anymore. It more resembles a savanna with, you know, some jungle, some proper foliage. So without elephants to control this thorny vegetation, it spreads, and this is unpalatable to many herbivores. So a lot of large grazing herbivores had left the region because there was not much food for them. Patterson never documented seeing any wildebeest or wild cattle, and other animals like zebras were very rare.
He did have a pet antelope, though.
He did have a pet antelope. Yeah, he did see a couple of these things, but he didn't see many. So to sum things up, in Kenya late 1800s, you had decreased prey animals due to hunting and urban expansion. And we had increased contact with humans and lions, an abundance of livestock to drive lions closer to civilization because they don't have other food. And you're in a region that's already pretty common for lion attacks. Combine all that with a bunch of emaciated workers not familiar with the landscape, sleeping in tents with little to no protection. It's a perfect storm for lion attacks.
Yeah.
Postmortem examination showed that the two lions were in relatively good health. Both were adult males and had little mane growth, and both were notably large lions, bigger on average. Patterson never found any signs of disease or wear other than a handful of bullet holes. At the time, one lion was found to have a damaged canine. And this was broken off. The bottom right canine was mostly gone. It was just kind of a nub there. This is critical to help a lion in gripping its prey. Patterson claimed that this was actually caused by a bullet, and it was during the process of being shot, he broke that tooth. But later investigation did show that both lions had pre-existing damages to their teeth. In fact, one of them had a completely misaligned jaw. It's likely an old injury from getting kicked by a prey animal. So one theory at the time was that these lions turn to people because they're easier to kill with damaged teeth. This theory has come under more scrutiny over the years, and it's more or less dismissed now. It's true that some lions known to kill people have been documented as having some sort of tooth or jaw damage. The opposite is actually equally as likely. Yeah, there's several lions postmortem have been found to be relatively healthy after killing a person. One study examined the length of canines in lions that had killed people, and it didn't find them to be significantly shorter or damaged at all. In fact, another study found only 15% of lions that attack people had damaged teeth. The teeth don't make it harder for them to subdue their prey. That's kind of like a common misconception. Their canines help them grip, but their bites are strong enough to snap its neck all on their own. They don't need the teeth to do that. It just makes them harder to hold on. So the dental theory has kind of been tossed aside. This paper does say that if they had an injury like a broken or messed up limb, that would be different. If they had something that prevented them from running down fast prey animals, then they might shift towards people. However, this is rare because if an animal gets an injured limb, it usually doesn't last much longer. Like I mentioned, lion attacks were also really common in this region. Throughout most of the history, predation of human on big cats is pretty common. Several incidents have occurred. In the 1920s, over 7,000 people were killed by tigers in India. In 1930s, over 1,500 people were killed in Tanzania by lions. And even modern day, lions still kill about 200 people per year in Africa.
Oh, wow.
I mean, that's okay. Not a huge amount, but that's still a bit. It's quite a bit. In Africa, lions have preyed on humans for centuries, although it's changed slightly. Rather than just straight up killing people, lions have been documented feeding on injured or dead slaves as they were transferred across the continent. So when the slave trade was big, you had a lot of people that didn't survive that process. That was just meals for lions. Lions were also known to eat the dead of some tribes in Africa because not all African cultures actually buried their dead. Some of them would just sort of place them on rocks or, you know, just take them out to the forest for a natural decomposition. And that's a free meal for big cats. It's been well documented that travelers and traders were regularly stalked by predators in Africa who didn't necessarily hunt them, but they would feed on the dead or the sick, whether that be a human or livestock. This was especially prominent during times of war, construction, or mass migrations. In World War One, lions would occasionally just pick off sentries. You know, someone alone on an outpost watching at night, the lion might get him. And on the other hand, if you're leaving behind a lot of dead men after battles, that's free food for lions. So the Tsavo man-eaters really weren't that out of the ordinary for the time. In fact, there were attacks months before Patterson even arrived in Africa. This incident doesn't seem like it was the bloodiest, it was just the best documented. And since it halted rail progress, it made it newsworthy. Male lions are actually, you know, usually the culprits for lion attacks anyways, and make up 50 to 80% depending on the region. And there's a lot less male lions than females, so that really skews towards males being the majority of attacks.
Why is that?
Lions, of course, they're in prides. A pride will typically consist of one adult male, several adult females, and then adolescent males who get booted out.
Okay.
So the males that get booted out, you know, they don't necessarily survive on their own. So the process kind of selects for one male to be in a group with several females. That's just their social structure. Because of that, 50 to 80% of all attacks being from males, and males being a fraction of the population in the majority of cases. So to sum everything up, the region was already low in large herbivores, thanks to a variety of seasonal and ecological changes. There had been a lot of close human contact, expanding territory construction into open wilderness areas previously not explored very well. Lions in the region have grown accustomed to feeding on dead or dying people over the centuries, thanks to trade routes, slavery, and wars. Lions also fed a lot on livestock, which put them in contact with people. During rail construction, many workers succumbed to disease, and a lot of them probably weren't properly buried. I'm guessing this gave lions an alternate food source. The rail construction was also right by the only source of fresh water in the region. Sorry, only major source of fresh water in the region. Meaning that that's where all the predators would go, because that's where the water is. So it was really just a well-documented case of lion attacks that gained national recognition. Adult male lions are usually the culprits anyways. The lions themselves did not solely feed on people, they just ate whatever they could. Other factors like seasonal variation and dental damage probably didn't play much a role at all. There was one theory that because it was the wet season, all the prey animals would disperse. But the fact is, there was very little prey animals for them to begin with anyways, so this probably didn't play that big a role.
Sure.
And the dental theory has largely been tossed out the window. Now the question remains, how many people did these lions actually kill? In the book, Patterson mentioned 14 deaths specifically. At the end, he claimed it was 28 Indian workers being documented as killed, and an unknown amount of local Africans. He retconned this years later, saying that there was over 100 locals killed, with a rough total of 135. So lions do have an active metabolism, and they're fully capable of eating that much food in a 10-month period. So could they eat that many people? Yes, but this seems unlikely. So one study actually did a DNA analysis from hairs stuck in the teeth of the lions. Actually, sometimes they had cavities, and hairs from their prey animals would get stuck in the cavities. And oh my God, like 100 years later, someone can extract that and get something from them. That's pretty cool. So the DNA analysis showed that they had hairs from warthog, zebra, impala, a couple other animals, but no human hair was found in the form of teeth samples. But also humans don't have much hair. The lions didn't really eat heads that often, and, you know, humans were mostly naked for the most part, so probably just didn't work its way in there. But this shows that the lions were not obligatory man-eaters, but they were opportunistic. Like I said, you have a bunch of cramped, defenseless guys sleeping in a cramped tent, probably sick, dehydrated, weary. Actually, Patterson said some nights it was so hot that they just slept outside on the ground. A lion is going to take advantage of that.
Yeah, very vulnerable.
Another study was on the dental wear of the Tsavo lions, and it found that the lions were not feeding on very dense prey items toward the end of their lives. This means that they were not eating the bones of their prey, which does contradict one of Patterson's observations that the lions were munching on bones, but, you know, that could have been anything. Or maybe they just weren't doing it often. It confirms that the Tsavo lions were eating softer food items. And this would line up with people. I guess we're squishier than your average meat. But they were not solely feeding on humans as their prey, but they did supplement their diet with them. And then we get to one of the most definitive studies on the Tsavo lion's diet. It's called Cooperation and Individuality Among Man-Eating Lions. This study utilized a technique known as stable isotope analysis. It utilizes ratios of non-radioactive isotopes to track movement or accumulation of organic material. I actually have a personal history with them. I use them for my undergraduate capstone, and I may be using it in the future as well. So this typically involves using ratios of carbon 13 to 12, and this tells you the original carbon source. So that is like what type of plants the lion's prey were eating. So when we use carbon stable isotopes, that can tell us the region they foraged in. You know, maybe they were focusing in a coastal environment. That's where they were hunting their prey. Or maybe it was more out in the scrubland. There's a lot of different things that can tell you. If you're an herbivore, it could just say what type of plants you're eating. And they also use nitrogen, 15 to 14. And that determines how high up on the food chain you are, because nitrogen accumulates with the more animals that are eating each other. So the animals on top of the food chain, like the hypercarnivores, they're the ones that have the highest ratios. These ratios are present in all life. And as you understand how they track and change throughout an ecosystem, you can study all sorts of things. Diet tends to be a big one. What's really useful about them is the more references you have, they're generated, you can compare all sorts of different specimens. So as you build up databases, you can compare this to that, to this, to that. But the best thing about stable isotopes is that you only need a tiny amount of tissue. That's why it's great for museum specimens. Because obviously you can't take like a whole head, grind it up, put it through a blender, it's like, you know, to see what we can get from that. But you can take a little bone sample, or you can take some hair samples. That's fine. So this is where stable isotope analysis really comes to shine. So they were able to utilize the teeth and hair of these lions over 100 years after they were killed. And they can compare these to modern lion values as a reference. They calculated this with an equation which involved the average amount of food a lion ate per day, how fast their hair growed, thus the length of the hair that would be in the last couple centimeters, or probably millimeters of the hair, represents the food and growth of the lions in the last couple months of their life. That little bit at the end represents their time as the man-eaters. And then they would also use the amount eaten from the average human corpse. They calculated an average of 10 to 24 humans consumed per lion, and thus an average of about 34 people, which is pretty close to the original 28 estimate, allowing for a couple extra people that weren't documented workers, maybe traders or some locals in the area. However, depending on the model you use, it could be as high as 70 people. So it's still far under the 135 count that the lions killed, but I think we can definitively say 34 is a safe average. You know, it could be up to 70, but probably not. It could also be as low as 10 if we're including the margin of error. But 34, you know, puts it right about in the middle. So the 135 count was probably embellished a bit down the line.
Yeah. Yeah, but that does line up with Patterson's initial account.
It did. Well, he said that there are 28 people documented as being eaten, according to like the rail company, but I haven't seen anywhere where these documents were published specifically. They might never be published. They probably got lost at the time. He said 28 at the start, plus, you know, a couple locals that weren't part of his crew. So, yeah, we'll say about 34 people by a pair of lions. Actually, not that high as far as lion attacks go. There's been years where it's been so much worse. But this is just an interesting case of, it's just well documented. A bit of sensationalism. You had this guy who came in, as newspapers describe, like a Hercules figure slaying a mighty beast. Of course, people are going to want to read all about that. Yeah, you get to see all the environmental changes that led up to this happening, where there's a lack of prey animals. Lions had been feeding on people more increasingly through various means as they come in closer contact over the years. And yeah, 100 years later, we're still able to study these two stuffed lion corpses that are kind of janky looking because Patterson used them as a rug. And that is my piece. You know, it was originally 10 pages long, but I actually cut it down to 8.
Wow. Wow. What a piece.
Deep into this. There's all kinds of other things like the history of lion attacks. It was interesting. Was it The Science of Man-Eating is definitely worth a read, but it is like a 40-page paper.
Yeah, that's probably the longest piece you've ever done for this podcast. That was quite in-depth.
The Beasts of Gévaudan was also up there, but I think this was... I definitely wrote a lot more for this one.
Right, right. All right, cool. Cool.
Oh, and like I said, you can still visit the lions to this day in the Chicago Field Museum of Natural History.
Tell them Patterson says hi. All right. Any ideas about our next episode then?
You have anything?
No, I honestly don't.
And a couple things. Keystone species.
Ooh, that's a good topic.
Have we done that?
No, we haven't. I like that one. Let's do that one.
All right, keystone species it is.
Yep. Anyone doesn't know, keystone species is going to be a species that's abnormally important to the functioning of an ecosystem.
And if you still don't understand that, you can learn all about it in the next episode.
Absolutely. All right. With that decided, you want to take us out?
Yep. If you enjoyed this episode, please give us a like or review on your podcast app of choice. And if you have a suggestion for a future episode, you can reach us at SoupPotPodcast on Twitter or theprimordialsouppot@gmail.com.
All right. Sounds good. Until next time, I'm Rustin.
And I'm Aaron.
See ya.